Sitting opposite me in the studio is my oldest friend, Barry Owen Jones. Barry was kind enough to come to Sydney to help me cut the ribbon on a new book. And I've dragged him into the studio to talk about not the book, but a political activity of Barry's, which I think it is important for you to know about. It's a consequence of Barry's improbable but very close friendship with the late Malcolm Fraser. And it has Barry thinking very seriously about launching a new political party. Now, remember this, Barry is a lifelong member of the ALP. He has been, he was a close friend of Whitlam's. He's been party president on two occasions. Yet his disenchantment with the Labor Party echoes Malcolm Fraser's disenchantment with the Liberals. And it got them both thinking that perhaps it was time for something quite dramatic. At the time, they decided that a good name for this party would be the Courage Party. Now, the name is still under discussion, under review. But, Barry, I want you to tell the listener why it is that you feel that after this lifetime of devotion to the Labour cause, you could be plotting something so outrageous.
Well, let me make one slight correction. Malcolm was never very enthusiastic about the name the Courage Party. I think he'd have preferred something like Reform. But in a sense, it was an examination that both of us had to say, are the two major political parties really dealing with the substantial issues, the critical issues that Australia needs to address over the next 30, 40 years? And the answer was that they're not, that both major parties are deeply flawed. I'd say one's more deeply flawed than the other because in the case of the coalition, they have to accommodate a different kind. The Liberal Party have to accommodate a different kind of political base, that is, with the National Party. And so the result is that in some ways, you'd have to say on a whole number of issues, their position's even much more unsatisfactory than the Labor Party. But the fact is that we've got, I think, an excessive degree of political convergence. And
well, let's look at one area, refugees.
Well, that's refugees a scandalous is case. The standout issue in this case. Because what happened is that essentially it demonstrates what I've called the fallacy of the false antithesis. That you say, well, really with refugees, there are only two types of problems to be, only two ways you can deal with them. Yeah. Only two possibilities. One is they drown at sea in the leaky boats which the asylum seekers have had to rely on. The second is that we put them in virtually concentration camps where they're not subject to the law, they're not subject to the scrutiny of democratic practice or processes and so on, in a way that is intolerable and absolutely counter to our recent history, I would think. But the point is that the two major parties say, well, we can't disagree because if we did disagree, then the voters would set upon us and beat us up. The point is, once you say, well, you've only got those alternatives when there are demonstrably many other alternatives, then, of course, there's nothing to talk about. There's no basis for discussion, no basis for debate. And sometimes when the Labor Party has done, I think, some appalling things, for example, they went happily along with the coalition over the issue of penalising whistleblowers, so that at one stage, if you had doctors and social workers who observed terrible things happening, well, they could be subject to a jail penalty if they dared to speak out. Now, that's absolutely intolerable, but the reason that my party, the party that I've been in since 1950, went along with it to say, oh, well, if we don't go along with it, then it simply means that the other mob will get worse. And what happened with Malcolm was that in the long discussions that we had, Malcolm was observing the fact that you had two political systems in which the branch memberships were getting smaller and smaller and smaller and somewhat unrepresentative of the broader community. Now, I read a statistic the other day, which seems implausible, but I read a statistic that said in the New South Wales Liberal Party, the average age of branch members is 77. Now, I don't know whether that's right, but if it were to be true, it might be that the ability to join the young Liberals might have to be reduced to 65 or so.
Barry, before we rush into that, I want to go back to this issue of convergence. Yes, refugees is a prime example. So surely is climate change.
Well, climate change is both of them are related areas where you've got a lot of empirical evidence that should be examined and scrutinised with a proper kind of debate, which we seem to be incapable of having here in Australia, in our parliament. And it's true at both. It's true with climate change as well. But I mean, just to go back to refugees for a moment. You see, when you consider that the problems that have had to be dealt with by countries in the Middle East are not in terms of hundreds or single thousands, they're really talking in terms of millions, hundreds of thousands. And when you say, well, just how big is the refugee problem in Australia, you say, well, at the moment, we've got 1,500 incarcerated. They think you're joking. If the whole political process is paralysed on this issue, and you're talking about 1,500, and it costs probably in excess of more than $1 million a year to keep them sequestrated, as one of my close friends said, really, it would make a lot more sense economically to simply go to those people individually and say, here's $1 million, just piss off and we never want to hear from you again. That's the absurdity of it. But going back to climate change, you see, the point is they ignore the science and concentrate on the politics always. And it's really been extraordinary the way in which the whole issue of climate change has morphed so that instead of thinking about the implications of destabilizing the climate so that you lose the equilibrium between the greenhouse gases that are produced day by day, season by season, and then are soaked up by the system. Once your equilibrium breaks down, as it does because of higher levels of consumption, higher population, higher per capita resource use, and so on, then you have a situation where maybe not in this life, not in necessarily in our lifetime, but 30, 40, 50 years down the track, the situation for Australia will be very dire.
So you want to break the political oligopoly?
Well, theoretically, because if you look at the number of problems that we have in Australia, a group of problems that I've called the Australian exceptionalism. I mean, we talk about American exceptionalism, of which their appalling gun laws are the outstanding example. But you see, we've got a whole series of problems which the political parties simply won't touch. According to The Economist, we're number one in the world in per capita expending on gambling. Number one in the world. But neither of the political parties will touch it, partly because state governments are very highly dependent on revenue that's coming in from gaming, and they don't want to lose that source. And the fact that you may have an increasing proportion of people, numbers of people who are driven to suicide, who are driven to theft, who are driven to embezzlement and so on, because they have these enormous gambling debts. But it's not a subject that can be debated. The one thing you can be sure about is that the two major political parties simply won't touch it.
Okay, now, being disruptive, you and I have a long friendship, or had a long friendship, with Ralph Nader.
Yep.
Was a hero of ours. When he became politically disruptive and stood as an independent in presidential campaigns, it tended to tilt the balance towards the Conservatives. And there is an argument that he helped George Bush, for example, achieve the White House. Isn't there a danger, even in talking about the notion of a courage party, in the same thing happening?
Absolutely, and that's what keeps me awake at night. But the question is, you say, but you've got to ask that fundamental question. Are the two political structures essentially self-regarding corporate oligarchies, or do they really respond and open up to democratic practice? And if the answer is no, they don't, you then have the moral question of saying, what do you do about it, if anything? The question as to whether it can succeed, that's another question. And I, at this point, I simply think of it as being a hypothesis, because in some ways, if we could get away from the kind of discipline that's exerted in our parliament, where, you know, for example, we've got out of the habit of having open debates on subject. Very occasionally, about once a decade, there might be a free vote on a subject, like the free vote they'll have in Victoria about the euthanasia legislation. But it's very, very rare.
Okay, so here's you doing a sort of a Guy Fawkes. You need to find some very prominent people to head up this hypothetical party. I can remember, we both remember, when a dissident in the Liberal Party formed the Australian Democrats, where
yes.
Don Chipp
That's right.
did and resolved for some time really was quite important. They did, to some extent, for some period, make the bastards honest. But someone has got to risk their career, perhaps sacrifice it, to take up cudgels on your behalf.
No, not on my behalf, on the part of the Australian community. The tragedy is this. This is the best educated cohort we've ever had in our history. There are 4.5 million graduates. But where are they when political debate is going on? You've got these tiny, atrophied party memberships, very small in both political parties. And yet it's curious. It's as if 16 million voters say, look, there's 2,000 of them, and there's only 15 million of us. We can't do anything about it. We've got to really open up the chasm and say there are not just two alternatives. And I think it's also true that the Greens don't operate much of an alternative. You mentioned the case of, not a completely satisfactory alternative. You talked about Ralph Nader earlier on. It's certainly true that in the American system, which is first past the post, I think Nader played a terrible role in ensuring that...
I remember begging him not to do it.
Absolutely. I thought it was absolutely... But I must say that at least that the Australian system is superior in some way, because it's a question of our preferential voting system ensures that if you had a serious kind of level of debate on these major issues, and people said, look, we're prepared to recognise that we ought to be thinking about climate change in terms, say, of the post-carbon economy, because although there are 17 elections between now and the year 2067, we can't wait until 2066 before we start taking the issue seriously.
So who would be the people drawn to this new structure? They would be the progressives, the genuine progressives in both major parties.
Yes, I think I wouldn't see it if it were to happen. And if it were to happen, it wouldn't be a centre party. It would have to be, well, to use that word again, a courageous party, even though it probably wouldn't have that name. It's got to be that challenges the Australian electorate to think issues through. But there's an absolute lack of courage on both sides, because every political leader is to a lesser or greater extent preoccupied about what's going to happen by internal party machinations and what's going to happen the next time round that there's an election. There's no long-term vision at all.
Do you think there are like-minded people within the coalition?
Some.
It keeps but, splintering but to some, the right, doesn't it? But
some, but I can see that part of the difficulty is that you'd have to get a critical mass of people who were credible, who were well-known, who had professional expertise, who had advocacy stills, but who were prepared to give up a lot. And they'd have to be people...
And risk a lot.
And risk a lot.
Yeah.
And risk a lot. And including the risk of failure. But if you reflect, you see, the tragedy of Australia, which we've never really talked through, you know, this is the weakest parliament relative to the size or compared to the power of the executive in the Western world. You see, in the United States, if they engage in war, it has to go to the Congress. If the Brits want to engage in war, it has to go to the...
That's a declared war in the US.
Well, yes. Well, that's true. But the point is, it certainly is discussed. In Australia, the line that we take about matters of war and peace is to say it's got nothing to do with the parliament. It's an executive decision. Now, there's no other country in the Western world that takes that view. Not even New Zealand, it goes to the parliament. But in Australia, we've weakened the parliament to such an extent that a lot of those fundamental issues are simply not discussed at the parliament. And that's a perversion of the whole democratic system.
How would you generate policy ideas? Here would be a lot of people sitting around, highly opinionated, very motivated, heavens above, working out a policy.
I think it would be easier than you would think. The point is that I was able to identify, after discussions with Malcolm, we identified 35 issues where we thought the position of the two major parties was unsatisfactory. I mean, I mentioned gambling before, and gambling's a classic illustration. And even Tony Windsor, with all his remarkable attributes, was a bit uneasy, understandably, about taking on the gaming industry in his own electorate. So that the result is that two major parties won't take on the gaming industry because they say, they can pour a lot of money into specific seats and they can make things difficult. So the result is it wouldn't be hard to work out an alternative policy in which you've got the two major parties linked together and you've got an alternative view that says there has to be some kind of rigid limitation to the amount of impulse gambling.
Indigenous policy.
Again, it's a matter of we don't have an unlimited amount of time to deal with that, but it's a matter of really having a deep sense of understanding of the issues, finding people who are credible, but getting together a knowledge base. I mean, some of the specific problems, like the one that I've been peripherally involved in, like trying to end blinding trachoma, for example. Once you get the evidence and you point to it and say a discrete amount of money can help solve this problem, then you're well on the way. But you've got to be prepared to look at it courageously, and you've got to be prepared not to be intimidated by vested interests, including the states.
I think it's extraordinary that an 85-year-old man, happy birthday, incidentally, is the great driving force in this notion.
Well, I don't think I am the great driving force. I'm one of those people who stays awake at night thinking about the future of this country for the next 20, 30 years. And although I've got friends on both sides of the political scene, and I know that I can only make enemies by speaking out the way I do, I feel a sense of profound concern.
Even though you'll be called a traitor by the Labor Party.
Well, that's a risk I've got to take. But I see not just the national interest. I see my preoccupations, I've got to say, are planetary. I'm concerned about the preservation of the species. I'm concerned about the interaction between the environment and the economy, because The economy is part of the environment. It's not the other way around. But nobody's talking this way. Nobody.
Barry, listeners will be intrigued by what they've heard from you. What can they do? Is there any way of getting in touch with you about this?
Final decisions won't be made by me. This will only happen if there's a groundswell of support.
How can that groundswell
as a whole
be communicated? How can it be identified? I mean, where is the shingle? Where is the website?
I think that I can't give an immediate answer to that because there are friends who are far more involved in an organisational way than I am. I'm still a member of the Labour Party, although I may well find myself expelled by this time next week, or perhaps they won't. They won't even bother because they'll say, "Well, he's 85, and you can't really expel a life member." And indeed, time will do it for us.
Okay, but you can see the point that I think there's a lot of people that really do want to see some courage in Australian politics that would like to see the oligopoly shaken up.
But it's got to be evidence-based. It's got to be evidence-based. And as it is, they're frightened of shadows. They say we can't have an open discussion about all these major issues. We can't talk about gambling. We can't talk about corruption.
We'll get back to you, Gladys and Potties. We will. Down the track, we'll keep informing you about the progress of this extraordinary idea, the Courage Party, or whatever it finishes up being called. Barry Owen-Jones, once again, happy birthday for your 85th, and thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Philip.